Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Welcome to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am your host, Randy Sutton. I'm a retired police lieutenant from the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department and 30-year police veteran. Each week, we'll be bringing you topical information about what's happening in law enforcement. We will have interesting guests that have tremendous insights into the world of policing and everything concerning policing. But first, let's go to the briefing room and talk about what's happening in policing this week. It's official. There never was a war on cops. That is the headline in the Washington Post from a couple months ago. The headline was quoted to me about a week ago. I did a national radio broadcast on a pretty major radio show. And the host said this to me. He says, this year will go down as one of the safest years in policing. When I asked him about what he was talking about, talked about a statistic, a single statistic, about the officers killed last year in 2015. He took that from the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund website. Now, the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund website is the spokesman for what is happening in Washington, D.C. at the Memorial Wall. That is a sacred ground for policing because that is where the names of every single police officer killed in the line of duty is engraved in the granite. And each year at Police Week, the men and women of law enforcement gather there to honor those who have fallen. So when he spouted this statistic about the safest for law enforcement, I had to question him. And he was talking only about the raw numbers of the police officers who were killed last year. And I said that, you know, let's not even talk about the humanity of the people who have been killed. Let's talk about the reality of what you call the safest year in policing. I said, that's just a raw statistic. That doesn't count all of the hundreds of police officers who were shot in the line of duty. It doesn't consider all of the police officers and law enforcement officers who were disabled in the line of duty. And I asked him if he knew how many police officers were assaulted last year, physically assaulted. He didn't know. And when I hit him with this statistic that more than 50,000, you heard that correctly, 50,000 law enforcement officers were physically assaulted last year. And this year, judging by the number of violent activities that have taken place against police, I think we're in for a record-breaking year. I want to talk about what's happened so far just since January. We've had 29 police officers die in the line of duty. 29 law enforcement officers die in the line of duty. And 16 of those were murdered. That's a very heavy statistic, and it doesn't bring to the reality the cost in the lives. It doesn't bring the families who have lost their husbands, their wives, their moms and their dads and their children. And there is no statistic that could ever bring that humanity to the fore. But that is the reality of policing. In addition to that, almost every single day since January, we're upwards of about 70 shootings of police officers. That's astronomical. It seems that every single day, another police officer is being shot. And so when I read this headline, there is no war on cops, it's official. That tells me exactly what the media wants to portray. The media has not been the friend of law enforcement this year, especially, and last year. When you talk about the war on policing, I look upon it as more than something just physical. The war on policing is much greater than that. Because the war on policing isn't just physical, it's emotional. It's police officers are under siege emotionally. They're under siege physically in many cases, but they're also under siege psychologically. And this has a dramatic effect on the morale of the men and women who serve, and also on the future of policing itself. Because what we are seeing is people leaving the field much earlier than they normally would have, and now we're seeing a tremendous drop in the recruitment. So that's all part of the war on police. You see, when I consider the war on police, the way I look at it, it's also the restaurant whose employees turn their backs on the uniformed officer who walks in and refuses them service. I believe that the war on police is the county prosecutor who publicly pronounces that making a traffic stop for no license plate is chicken shit and cites it as a reason to charge an officer with murder when the driver of that car is killed. I also think that the war on police is the rich and famous pop star who uses her music and her influence to celebrate cop killers and denigrate police officers. I think it's the Washington Senate bill proposal that makes it easier to prosecute police officers for officer-involved shootings. Yeah, the war on police is much more than just physical. I think it's the professional sports team that runs onto the field with their hands in the air in support of the great lie of Ferguson, hands up, don't shoot. You know, the war on police is when an ABC primetime television show weaves into their plot line the narrative that police are trigger-happy racists intent on committing acts of violence against innocent citizens. And the war on police is the President of the United States, who not even a year into his first term, publicly says that a Cambridge police sergeant acted stupidly, and I'll quote that, acted stupidly, when a college professor buddy of his gets arrested for acting stupidly. That's all part of what I consider the war on police. And we can go on and on about what has taken place since Ferguson. The physical attacks that have been televised, the media attacks that have driven a narrative that has not only enhanced the people to attack police physically, but also to attack them publicly, verbally, spitting on them at events like even a political rally. We are seeing an incredible lack of leadership. We are seeing a politically motivated sense that is more than disturbing. And we're going to get more into that as this show continues. But for now, let's take a break. I'm Randy Sutton. You can contact me at randysutton@outloudamerica.com. And this is the Out Loud America Network. I have a very special guest today, a man who I met while I was doing my book, The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People. And this guest today has become one of my personal heroes. He has had a storied life. He has touched the lives of millions of people around the country in many, many ways. And he has spent almost 40 years as a law enforcement officer, both with the Arizona DPS as a trooper, and then later on with a police department And you might know him for something else that he did while he was a Arizona DPS trooper. He created an organization that has touched the lives of millions. It's called the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Ladies and gentlemen, my special guest today, Mr. Frank Shankwitz. Frank, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Well, Randy, thank you for inviting me, and I appreciate those kind words. Kind of humbling, but keep it up. I'm kind of enjoying that.
Enjoy it while you can, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Frank, talk about the early days of your law enforcement career, and you know, much of this audience that is listening today are either active duty or retired law enforcement officers or people that truly support law enforcement. So let's talk about when you made the decision to become a police officer. What was it that motivated you to do that?
I was in the Air Force. I did 4 years in the Air Force, Vietnam era, but I was not in country. And my job in the Air Force then was called Air Police. Everything from security at the B-52 bombers, I was with the Strategic Air Command, to missile silo duty, and then when transferred to Europe, got involved with base police and also a little bit with the Office of Special Investigations, actually doing police investigation, which piqued my interest. However, after my service, I returned to Arizona, and there was a big push to hire veterans at that time, Vietnam veterans. And Motorola was really, they had a big operation in Phoenix, and again, seeking veterans because of the discipline, the work ethic, everything else. And the pay was excellent, more than anything I could think about. And joined Motorola, immediately went into their engineer training program and advanced very fast. Stayed there for 7 years. But to tell you the truth, got very bored. I was raised in northern Arizona, little towns, little communities, working on ranches, working just type of work. Typical rural type environment. And I got very bored with that city life, didn't like it. And several of my friends that I went to high school with had joined the Arizona Highway Patrol and kept encouraging me to join. And on a whim, I put in an application, took the test, placed very high placement. I was accepted for the academy. And a decision, am I going to leave a job that was paying several thousand a year more and take a big pay cut or do it? But I wanted the adventure. I was kind of an adrenaline junkie, so I wanted that adventure. And that started that whole career with the Arizona Highway Patrol, which is a division of the Arizona Department of Public Safety. And I hate to correct somebody on the air, but it was 42 years, Randy. And all of the same agency. I started out as a uniform officer, went into immediately, they started a motorcycle program. In fact, we trained with California Highway Patrol initially, and everything was the same. Our uniforms, our motorcycles, all except ours said, obviously, Arizona instead of California. So that was the most fun. I did that for 12 years, just the whole state. And then some very rotten places to have to work, such as the Grand Canyon, Monument Valley, Sedona, Oak Creek, Tombstone, you know, places that you just really don't want to be. But like they say, Randy, somebody had to do it.
And that was, of course, the days of the television show Chips, which played a pretty big role in your life, correct?
Yes, Chips was a real popular show. And before the children, we go into town, and I don't know how many times we'd heard the comment, but we always ride in a two-man team, just like the Chips type thing. And you hear a mother say to their young child, there's a police officer, you don't be good. They're going to pick you up and take you to jail. Now, Chips started, and all of a sudden, we ride into the towns, and the little kids are just waving, hey, Punch, hey, Joe, hey, Chips. And it was the greatest public relations thing for us. In fact, when we had some extra time, with the permission of our commanders, we go to the little local grade schools and talk about bicycle safety, which the kids could care less about. But they wanted to get on on motorcycles, play with the sirens and lights. And again, a great PR.
You know, it's amazing the role that television can play and the media can play in either making policing positive or making policing negative.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And that was such a positive thing, like I say, in that time. The kids just loved that. We actually started going to some of the junior high, the middle school and high school, too. And that was almost like, especially in high school, like a job fair promotion type thing.
Right, right. Well, before I go back to some significant things that happened during that particular time in your life, you spent literally 42 years as a police officer. So after your stint in on motors, and you worked narcotics and some other cases, where did you go from there? And tell us about the latter part of your career.
The latter part of career, say narcotics, working first deep undercover and just the intelligent part of it, but in the homicide section, that was the majority of my career. And Arizona being like state police, the little small towns, county cities that did not have their own homicide unit. That's what we got called in, which was the majority of Arizona. But the biggest thing is we took our initial training with Phoenix PD, which was excellent, excellent training. And then I was chosen of the one of the people throughout, there was one person per state that went to New York State Police homicide training for a month training course, which is excellent. We had excellent training, and the big thing was we got to use that training. It wasn't just a book thing, and then you, okay, maybe I forgot it.
Right, right. And if I'm not mistaken, you recently put a murderer away from a cold case, correct?
Yes, I was assigned to help Prescott Police Department, a little town in northern Arizona, with a cold case that they were having, and it was a 2002 homicide where a man was found in his residence, beaten with a rock on his head, and then stabbed several times, stabbed to death. And the suspect was his wife, but Prescott PD did not have the proper people to do that, and it went cold, and they called us in, and we started looking at it again. And it took me until that would happen in 2002. I was assigned 2010 to it. 2012, I finally located the suspect in Indiana with the help of Indiana State Police, and in fact went back to Indiana. And we weren't going to arrest her. We just wanted to make sure of an ID. And it was so much fun. Indiana State Police said, "You go to the door by yourself, ID yourself. We want to see the reaction," which I did. And this lady thought she had got away with the hiding. And when she opened that door and I showed the ID and advised her that pretty soon she's going to come back to Arizona to stand trial, which she did in 2015. And just last week, we got the final sentencing on her, and she was sentenced to life in prison for the murder of her husband. It was her husband that she killed. So that's you can run, but you can't hide. That took a lot of years to finish, but that was the final investigation.
That's a hell of a way to end. That is a hell of a way to end your police career with a conviction for murder. That's fantastic. Let's go back just a little bit now. There was a really significant incident that took place when you were a motor officer that changed the course of your life. And I'd like you to just talk about that for a moment, involving that DUI.
Well, as motor officers, you have this saying that those that are wrecked and those that are going to. And I was involved in a high-speed chase in Parker, Arizona. This is on the Arizona-California border and the Colorado River. And in the spring break time, it just became just thousands and thousands of kids, college and high school, drunk, drugs, just the whole thing. And I was involved with this high-speed chase with a drunk driver. It was a 25-mile zone with curves and twists and everything right by the river. He's going 80 miles an hour. We're chasing him and when I say we, me and my partner, and another drunk driver pulled out from a stop sign right in front of me. I hit him broadside at 80 miles an hour. And I was told later the crash was spectacular.
I bet it was.
But it was one of those instances where, and it's hard to explain, where when I hit, I was pronounced dead at the scene. My partner could not revive me. He tried. He called in for our code 963A, officer killed on the line of duty. And I experienced what I found out later. I didn't know this at the time. I experienced what is called the tunnel. And as you die, and this happens a lot in emergency rooms, as you die, the light kind of closes like you're looking down a tunnel. And all of a sudden, it just gets smaller and smaller and closes. And when it shuts, you're dead. An off-duty emergency room nurse, in fact, from California, pulled up on the scene and asked if she could please try to revive me. She identified herself, and they said he's dead. She said, please, this lady worked on me for 4 more minutes and, in fact, brought me back to life. And there's a little funny story on that, if I may.
Sure.
And again, I learned this talk to the psychologist. As that tunnel starts opening again, when they're bringing you back to life, you have these, your senses start coming back. And my first sense was the sense of touch or feel. And I felt something tickling my face. And then the sense of smell, and just a very sweet smell, almost like a perfume. And then your hearing comes back. I'm hearing the sirens. I'm hearing people yell. She brought him back. And then my vision starts coming back from the blurry. And as my eyes open, I focus on this beautiful blonde that's got a lip lock on my lips. And I'm thinking, if this is heaven, this is great. I'm loving this. When in fact, it was just this nurse who was just this knockout. Now, I learned later also that my partner had tried the mouth-to-mouth, and I'm glad I didn't wake up to him. He's this big, ugly guy with his mustache that was always full of bugs and everything. And that would have been a traumatic thing to wake up to. But as you know, Randy, most police officers believe in a higher being. We go to work every day. We say a little prayer. Please allow us to come home. You get home, and you just say a little prayer. Thank you for allowing me to come home. And it took 6 months to recover from that accident. I had skull fracture. I had a bruised brain. I had typical road rash and a couple broken bones and that. And I just kept saying, why did God allow me to survive this? What's the purpose? How come I survived that accident? And I got the answer to that a couple of years later.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that's the perfect segue. I think that, you know, for the listeners that don't know your amazing story, this was what took place in Frank's life up to this point was preparing him for perhaps what his true mission was.
April of 1980, and as I mentioned, I'm on a squad that works in the state of Arizona. And I was about 100 miles away from Phoenix, from our headquarters building in Phoenix, up in the mountains, one of those beautiful days, start at 5 in the morning, very chilly up in the mountains, clear. And it's kind of ride that motorcycle as a joy instead of patrolling. And I get a call from my dispatcher to please find the nearest payphone as quick as possible. And this is 1980. There's no cell phones at the time. It took me 50 miles. And she said, head back to Phoenix, by the way. It's an emergency, but it does not involve your family. So it took 50 miles to find the nearest payphone. And I called in, and she said, hey, we have a situation. There's a little boy, 7 years old, who has leukemia. He only has a few weeks to live. His heroes are Punch and John from the television show Chip. And that's all he thinks about. And he tells his mom, when I grow up, I'm going to be a highway patrol motorcycle officer, just like Punch and John. And the family had called Arizona Highway Patrol and asked if there's some way that he could meet a motorcycle officer and just spend some time with one of our motorcycle officers. Again, because we look so much like the CHP officer. She told me that the director had asked that I be chosen for that duty to meet him because of my work with the children in previous years. And the fun part for us police officers, I was authorized to go code 2 to Phoenix, which means I could break every traffic law and not worry about a letter of complaint. And what they asked was just about when I was about 15 minutes away to let them know, because the helicopter was going to transport this little boy, our state police helicopter, from his hospital to our headquarters building. And that's why I would be standing by to meet this little boy. And this all went about. I got there just in time. The helicopter comes in. I expected this very sick little boy to be helped up by our paramedics because they told me he's dying. He's on IVs. He's at the hospital. Instead, this little bound of energy just jumps out of that helicopter runs over to the motorcycle. Hi, I'm Chris. Wow, you look like Punch and John. Because I was very tan at the time and had red hair, so I could have been either Punch or John. So. But this little boy was just ecstatic to see the motorcycle, see the uniform. Can I get on it? Yes, you can. Play with the red lights and sirens. As far as he was concerned, he was looking at somebody for just. But I noticed his mother. She's sitting there with a tear in her eye because she's looking at a seven-year-old boy who had been so sick, and now he's running around like a typical just little seven-year-old boy. But Chris went on that day to become the first and only honorary highway patrol officer in the history of Arizona Highway Patrol, and toured the compound, toured the armory, everything, his certificate, his own badge was assigned to him, which is still assigned to him today, the smoky hat. And he got to go home that night, Randy, instead of back to the hospital. His doctor, who was with him, said, I don't understand. His vitals are so good. Let him go to his comfort zone. He does not have to go back to the hospital. But at the end of the day, we felt pretty good what we had done for Chris. And we dawned on us, we have a highway patrol without a uniform. Go to the uniform shop. They're just closing. It's about 5 o'clock. Uniforms are custom made in those days. Can you help us out? Can you make a uniform for this little seven-year-old boy? He's about this wide, about this high, trying to give him the sizes. Two ladies spent all night making a uniform for Chris. The next day, with permission of our commanders, I led several motorcycles and highway patrol cars out to his neighborhood. Red lights and siren, you can imagine the neighbors. He comes running out. We hand him his uniform. This little boy is just ecstatic. Runs in, changes, comes out just beaming. But he comes over to me and gets on a motorcycle again and starts touching the motorcycle wings that we wear on our uniform. Frank, how do I be a motorcycle officer? That's what I really want. That's my wish. And that's the first time I'd heard that word, wish.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just explained to Chris what the training we do, just kind of teasing him a little bit. And I said, it's a shame you don't have a motorcycle. We set up traffic cones right in your driveway and test you right now. Chris was a step ahead of me. He runs in the house, comes riding out on a little battery-operated motorcycle that his mother had got for him in place of a wheelchair. He's got on the helmet. He's got on the aviator glasses. He's all set.
Amazing.
We give him his little test. He goes through it. Did I pass? Yes, you did, Chris. When do I get my motorcycle wings? I did order the wings. Those are custom-made. It was going to take a couple days. Just as I picked up the wings, I get a call. Chris is back in the hospital in a coma. He's not expected to survive the day. I received permission to go to his hospital. His uniform was hanging right by his bed. Just as I pinned the wings on his uniform, Chris came out of the coma. He looked at me very weak. Am I a motorcycle officer now? Yes, you are, Chris. He just started giggling. He asked for his uniform. I handed it to him. He's touching the wings. He's showing his mom. This little boy, his wish had come true. He's now a highway patrol motorcycle officer. And unfortunately, he passed away a few hours later. And I was kind of thinking maybe those wings helped carry him to heaven. But we learned Chris was going to be buried in Illinois. And I was asked to go back with another officer, motorcycle officer, to get Chris a full police funeral. We had lost a fellow officer. Chris was buried in uniform. His grave mark reads, Chris Gracious, Arizona Trooper. But coming home, Randy, I just started thinking this little boy had that wish, and we made it happen. Why can't we do that for other children? And at 36,000 feet, that's when the idea of the Make-A-Wish Foundation was born.
That is one of the most inspirational stories that I think that I've ever heard, Frank. And you know, for the people that are listening to this broadcast, I think the reveal here is how law enforcement officers touch the lives of so many people in so many different ways. And the opportunities for playing a positive role in the lives of others is something that every police officer lives for. And happily, you were in the right place. Your heart was in the right place as well to create an organization that has quite literally touched the lives of millions of people around the world. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time to tell your story, Frank, and to say that not only did you serve your community and serve your country as a law enforcement officer, as a as a member of the armed services, but you have continued to serve in ways that that have touched the lives of millions of people. It's an honor to know you. It's an honor to have you on this show. So,
well, thank you, Randy. Thank you so much. And as a fellow officer, I know your background and history. I just thank you, too, for what you've done.
I appreciate it. I call this segment of the show Police Story. Since this is the voice of American law enforcement, each week we will feature a story written by an active duty police officer, retired or former police officer, about something that affected their lives during their careers. Every police officer, every law enforcement officer has amazing stories. Some are touching, some are funny. Some are very impactful. This particular story is the first in this series. If you have a story that you would like to contribute, contact me and we'll see if we can't get it on the air. This story was sent to me by a former police officer. It is it has a tremendous amount of impact and was recently featured on several police websites. It definitely is a must hear for everyone who supports law enforcement and officers who have been involved in line of duty shootings. It is called A Letter to the Man I Killed. Some people know this about me, others do not. I have killed a man. This is not a confession, it is just a fact. I have nothing to hide about it. I'm not ashamed of the fact. I have no regrets about doing it. I was doing my job. At the time of your death, I was a police officer, and you tried your best to kill me. I am the police officer that killed you. I hope you are not long in your suffering, but as I am aware during the short time I spent with you, listening to your cries of agony and for mercy, and the curses you spat at me, I endured as you bled to death. I endured. I hope you had a chance to reconcile with our Creator before you went, and that angels bore you away to a better place. I would have prayed with you had there been time, but there was not, so I could only pray for you. And occasionally, I still do. People who choose a path like the one you chose probably don't weigh into the equation the most dreadful consequences of their actions. I weighed it into my own equation every day as a police officer. I have experience with death. In fact, death and I are quite intimate with each other. You have your death. I died a physical death once, albeit briefly, but I was brought back. I wondered for what? A specific event? Your death? I never really feared a physical death. When I came back, that lack of fear was reaffirmed. I suppose that made me infinitely more dangerous as an adversary. More so than someone merely chest-thumping with a nothing-to-lose attitude at the risk of sounding cliché. I took your life, I get that. But still, you took something from me, and you changed me forever. I've been a hunter for most of my life, including a hunter of armed men. What Hemingway said about the hunting of armed men and killing and liking it is true. You never really care for anything else thereafter. I hunt animals still, but often do not pull the trigger. Perhaps in time, that will change. Killing a man is nothing to take lightly. It changes you. It changes what people think about you. You aren't the same person anymore. And still, I love life. I revel in the beauty of it, both the simplicities and the intricacies of it. I appreciate life. This solitary act does not define me. It doesn't even scratch the surface.
People who do not know talk about it as though it was no big deal, but I will tell you, it's a huge deal. Get over it. Put it behind you. Try not to think about it. Which are all great thoughts, were it that easy. Who wouldn't? But it doesn't work that way. Perhaps people would begin to understand the gravity of it were they to see a police officer choking on the barrel of their own gun trying to turn it off, or writing about it with the muzzle of a gun pressed against their temple. Some succumb to the haunting despair. I will not. To the contrary, I consider it a visit from an old enemy. I sometimes welcome the nightmares, the gore, and the violence, to let it know it will never best me. The outcome is the same at its base. I live. Whatever attacks me does not. They fail. I survive. When I awaken from my sleep, if you can call it that, dripping, slick with sweat, heart pounding, I am still alive. I get to relive our event every day since it happened. Not because I want to. I have no choice. It just comes calling whenever it feels like it. No warning. It just intrudes multiple times a day. What triggers it? Everything and nothing at all. I'm always expecting the unexpected, always aware. I have a heightened tactical plan to kill everyone I meet. Only a police officer or soldier would understand that. It's not paranoia. I am situationally aware, even in my dreams. Realistically, there is always a target on my back, but that's what I signed up for when I pinned on the badge. That's just part of what it's like to be a police officer. Walt Whitman said, "If you done it, it ain't bragging." But if you haven't done it, the things I have done, your opinion, armchair quarterbacking, and constant shuffling of the what-if deck really doesn't mean shit to me. For the most part, well, you cheated a little, but it was still a fight to the death, your death. But I don't hate you, truth to be told. I just feel sorry for you. Oddly, I have not shed one tear for you, and I've cried many times during my career. My lamentation over the loss of my favorite bird dog was loud, tearful, and long-lasting. Maybe because he was a true friend, and you were just what you were, my enemy. And that changes everything. You made fatal mistakes. Young and invincible, tough guy, full of bravado, whether false or real. You had choices, and you made poor ones. I was already committed when I climbed out of my patrol car and stood on that asphalt. Perhaps you just hesitated, or maybe were just too slow. The latter is an obvious fact. Everything else is merely speculation. I'd like to thank you for some things, looking over my shoulder for the rest of my life, and for cutting my career 13 years short. Thanks for helping me see that my department was totally incapable of handling the shooting investigation and subsequent homicide investigation. It perfectly illustrated the creed, a false friend is more dangerous than a known enemy. It was a real eye-opener after many years on the job to realize that incompetent supervisors and politicians have no hesitation to hang a target on the back of a good police officer for doing his job and doing it well. I wonder how many other officers have had their civil rights violated by their own departments during post-shooting investigation fiascos. Police officers have rights too. Please keep that in mind. While my career was cut short, I'm thankful I would never again at that agency have to endure shoddy procedures and listening about my other options in a justified deadly force scenario from cowards and idiots. Nor will I have to worry about being returned to the front lines as soon as possible without a chance to decompress, not worry that a modicum of protection would be afforded my family, who has suffered greatly at their hands. I remember visiting the scene of the shooting on the first anniversary of your death, not knowing what I would find there. What I find there was absolutely nothing to mark the occasion. There was, however, a small token of remembrance there when I left. That struck me as very sad. The only one who bothered to pay their respects was the one who put you in the ground. Were I able, I would sit down and share a drink with you, and a fine meal. I would do so before I broke bread with some of my so-called brothers or the politicians from my own town who were so quick to feed us to the wolves. I mean that with every fiber of my soul. You are a worthy adversary. I thank you for bringing a real gun to a real gunfight. I thank you for turning your attention to me and leaving the younger officer alone. I thank you for the baggage that keeps me in a perpetual state of being physically and mentally worn out. Perhaps I'll see you on the other side. If you reconciled and the angels came to take you away to a heaven that early summer morning. If so, maybe we can have that drink and share a meal. If not, you made another bad choice, infinitely worse than the first, and I will never see you again. With sincerity, the police officer that killed you. That story demonstrates the real feelings that happen when a police officer is involved in a line of duty shooting, when they are forced to take the life of a human being. Despite all of the press and the media that portray the police as bloodthirsty, racist creatures that enjoy hurting people, that was the reality that you just heard. The pain, the hurt, the looking back, the fact that it changes your life forever. That's what policing does.